Last week on Current State, we brought you the saga of the Great Lakes ship, the SS Henry B. Smith. The life and loss of the Smith is a central story to a new book by Marquette-based author Frederick Stonehouse. The Last Laker, Finding a Wreck Lost in the Great Lakes' Deadliest Storm, recalled the 1913 hurricane-strength storm that ripped through the lakes, resulting in the greatest loss of life and ships from a single storm to date. For a century, the Henry B. Smith eluded divers and maritime experts. The Smith's life, death, and rediscovery are vividly recreated in The Last Laker. In this second installment of their two-part conversation, Current State's Peter Wharf and Frederick Stonehouse discuss the storm's outbreak. The Henry B. Smith captain, James Owen, was misled by the calm conditions on Lake Superior as he set sail that fateful November day.
Others got caught periodically in the same type of situation that was not unknown when a major storm came through. I would hesitate to call it a rookie mistake as much as an error in judgment legitimately made.
Right.
But again, a well-seasoned captain had an excellent, excellent record. So I don't think that was something that was a... I don't think that was a decision made lightly. I think it was a decision based on what his weather sense told him. And that's what many of the old-time captains really went by, is what they saw as weather signs. And in this case, it just proved to be a very fatal mistake.
There's a photograph that I thought was fascinating on page 71 of your book with the caption, "Lake Huron's Canadian shore was littered with lost sailors." I've never really seen a photo like this before, almost like the beach on an amphibious invasion, where you see a man standing over several drowned men on the shores of Lake Huron.
It did indeed, and many of them would end up on the kind of the south east shore of Lake Huron, where they were policed up and taken to local morgues as such as they could find them. In some cases, the furniture store doubled as one because they had nothing else in town. Certainly a very sad circumstance in many ways, obviously.
The Last Laker is the new book by Frederick Stonehouse. We're talking with him right now on Current State. You talk about those last moments of the Smith and what those might have been like. Can I read a little bit from page 115 for a second?
Please do.
This is some of the last moments that Frederick Stonehouse describes of the Smith in Lake Superior and Captain Owen. A veteran and highly capable sailor, Captain Owen fought the storm with all of his substantial skill, but was losing the battle in the increasing maelstrom. His standing rigging was screaming from the rising wind. Soon it was howling, a chorus suitable for a priestly choir from the Spanish Inquisition, intended to drown out the terrible screams of their innocent and helpless victims. Once the hatch covers started to loosen, the fight was over. If the covers breached during darkness, Captain Owen likely never would have known, unable to see the black deck stretching behind him. Although his generator provided electric power for deck lights, nearly all were smashed already by the waves. The surging water searched out every weakness, flooding into the cargo holds with every passing wave. Although the engineers kept their big steam pumps clanging away at full capacity, they couldn't expel the water quickly enough as it poured through the smashed stern cabin doors and down deep into the engine room and bilges. Waves ripped doors off their hinges, skylights and porthole stove, and bulkheads knocked asunder. The lifeboats were long since swept off their davits and blown into the lake. Losing the lifeboats made no difference anyway. There wasn't a boat made that could survive the terrible uproar of wind or water or crew capable of launching one in the screaming storm anyway. The end for the Smith and her crew was coming soon. You talked a little bit about those cargo holds and the idea of canvas covers, and maybe that was a possibility for the flooding.
Yeah, and that's part of part of the challenge of writing a book like this is trying to figure out what happened. What could have happened, obviously, we're not making definitive decisions. But this particular ship, as did several others that came out of the yards, had something called a telescoping hatch cover. And essentially what it is was a series of leaves that folded in on one another. So you had five from the right side, five from the left side. Then they had a chain drive that allowed them to slide open one on top of the other or shut them the same way in reverse. And they had a small lipping device then that held to the combing, or that portion of the hatch where it comes through the hull, so they kind of locked in place. It was a good theory. It worked well in calm water when you really didn't have boarding seas or any significant wave damage potential. But if you took that out into the conditions that the Smiths were in, the only way you could be certain that those hatches did not leak, because this was steel on steel and many little pieces of steel on steel, was to cover them with a heavy tarp or tarpaulin. And then in turn, you had strong backs or heavy pieces of wood or other steel then across the top of the hatch that would be fastened down to the hatch using what were known as C-clamps, much like you would see a clamp used in furniture making. And those together then would lock that hatch very tight, very secure, very watertight. Captain Owen did not put those additional tarpaulins on the hatch because when he looked out of the harbor and saw the lull coming through, it was his belief that the storm was broken, the waves were falling off, and there was no reason to put the crew through the work of putting this added level of protection on. So as a result, when she got into the storm conditions, the waves were powerful enough to be able to peel back those hatch covers, and that steel was I think, 3/8-inch diameter, or 3/8-inch thickness, so that those begin to fold back, much like you would take the leaves of an avocado and pull them off as trying to reach the fruit within. And once you lost one section of a hatch, then it was Katie bar the door, because that then would become a torrent of water going into the cargo hold. The cargo hold was common. In other words, the entire length of the ship, there were no watertight divisions within the hold, so the water would migrate wherever it wanted to go once it got into the cargo. And then, of course, one hatch went, another hatch went, another hatch went. And in looking at the underwater videography of the wreck, it is very clear that virtually every hatch cover was gone. And the dynamic of how they lost them, both storm action as well as the ship diving to the bottom and then the air pressure within blowing them off, is certainly another hypothesis that would account for many. But that was the weakness in the Henry B. Smith, and also the weakness in several other Lake Superior shipwrecks that were lost. Again, arguably the same reason, that particular design of hatch. But let me make one thing clear. I didn't find this wreck.
Right, I know.
I want to be very clear that the team that did find it, Jerry Eliason and Ken Merriman and Craig Smith, three folks from Minnesota that have been very successful in finding these Great Lake shipwrecks. I think they've got a dozen or so under their belt, and I need to give all the accolades I can to their tremendous ethic and skill set in being able to do so.
We'll get back to more about the Smith in just a second. I wanted to ask you about another story that I thought had some really fascinating details, and those were the losses of the Regina and the Price.
Right. Regina and Price were two Canadian vessels, both of them lost in the storm. It really didn't come to light what had happened with these two ships until they began to look at the bodies along the Canadian shore. And what they found were Regina's survivors, not survivors, Regina bodies wearing life jackets from the Price, and Price bodies wearing life jackets from the Regina.
Right.
And once they realized that, then you began to have stories and hypotheses that suggested that these two ships had collided somewhere in the lake, and the crew from one jumped to the other, and they didn't have their own life jackets, so they were given the life jackets, two from the other ship. The reality proved to be far more macabre. What had happened was the bodies had come ashore on the Canadian shore. The locals had come down to the bodies and had literally stripped them of valuables, and including any of the life jackets that were on the bodies. When the Canadian police realized what was happening, they had put out the threat that if everything didn't go back to where the locals found it, then there would be charges rendered against the folks that were doing the ghoulish behavior. So they went back to the beach, they put the jackets back on the bodies, and as a result, they often put them on the wrong body. So that then is what caused the whole theory of the collision between the two ships.
I really liked what Jerry Eliason said about the Smith, which is, in a lot of ways, the central character of this book. Jerry said, "The Henry B. Smith has it all. History, mystery, and a beautiful wreck." What did you think about that?
I think Jerry's right on. I mean, this is a wreck that's sitting on the bottom, other than being cracked amidship, largely intact. And it is certainly what you would, if you were in Hollywood trying to put together what a shipwreck would look like, it would be the Henry B.
Frederick Stonehouse is the author of the new book, The Last Laker, Finding a Wreck Lost in the Great Lakes' Deadliest Storm. Frederick, thanks a lot for the conversation and the great history.
Well, you're very gracious. Thank you for allowing me to speak about a subject which I'm passionate about and which I just find fascinating.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.